Can a survey change the future? Maybe this one can. Cannabis education is inconsistent at best and missing or misleading at worst. How can we make cannabis education better? What if we ask people who use or are thinking about using cannabis a bunch of questions? What if we ask pharmacists who could be teaching people about cannabis a bunch of questions? And then, what if the answers from those questions were used to help pharmacists teach people about cannabis better? Well, this is exactly what pharmacists as cannabis educators, or PACE, are doing. And PACE needs you to fill out a survey. PACE needs as many people as possible to fill out a survey. PACE needs you to fill out a survey on or before May 12th. This is a limited time offer for you to help change the future of cannabis education. To participate, go to promo.reefermed.ca. That's promo, P-R-O-M-O dot reefermed.ca.
It's Reefer Madness, the podcast with Trevor and Kirk.
Kirk, we're back. Well, I'm back. Hey. Where are you?
Well, Trevor, COVID has made my life rather interesting. I'm right now currently sitting just north of Brandon in a little community called Forest on Highway 10, traveling to Brandon.
All right. Well, COVID restrictions are lifting in Manitoba, so I can physically be in the studio. You've still got to be doing some socially distancing things, so you're not. And that's why it sounds a little different today.
My world is basically four weeks in community and 4 weeks home. And out of the 4 weeks home, I have to spend 2 weeks still socially isolating from friends. So I basically have 2 weeks every six in which to live my life. Hence, Michelle and I are traveling to Brandon to get some commerce done, visit some grandchildren.
No, that's good. They got to see the grandchildren. So I'm Trevor Schufelt. I'm the pharmacist. Who are you?
I'm Kirk Magwas. I'm the nurse, and we are Reefer Madness.
So Kirk, I brought Igor. I'm really excited about this one. I know it's a little dense and a little sciencey on this one, but we'll do our best to sort of walk people through it. But so we finally get to say we have a COVID episode.
Yeah, this has been a fun episode. I've been listening to your interview for the last couple of days, and I've actually been doing a lot of research again on my own here. And I guess the first thing to talk about, this whole concept of preprint. You and Igor get into it.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I was listening to him, all the preprint is, to make it in layman's terms, it's basically a very public way to get the peers to review your paper.
Yeah, it's pre-COVID, I'd never heard of the word preprint. And like Igor said, he has published over 150 peer-reviewed articles. But preprints, especially in this world of COVID, seems to be a way to kind of dump your info out there for the world to read. But still, if you want it to go into a journal later, it's still got to go through the peer review process. It sounds like you're still going to, they'll basically check your spelling and make sure it's in the right format, but they're not doing any of the fact checking that peer review usually does. And like Igor was saying, and it's a speed thing, right? Because he said, you know, when normally it gets a peer reviewed paper, it is, you know, you submit it to a paper and they like it, they don't like it, they send you. And, you know, the whole process can take, you know, literal years, 1 to 3 years to get your thing through peer review. So not surprisingly, right now, we want as much COVID info out there. And the quote I heard was there's like 4,000 preprints a week COVID related going on. So that's great. We can, you know, we the public can see all this info and the scientists and the doctors can see all this info. But the downside is basically, I think the easiest way is it hasn't been fact checked yet.
Well, but peers are reviewing these preprint papers, so you are getting your peer review done. You're just doing it in a very public way.
Well, yeah, but by peer review, I've never published a peer review paper, so all you published scientists can yell at me. My understanding is peer review is specifically going to be four or five people that publication has picked to look at your paper, to fact check it, to ask you a bunch of questions, and a bunch of correspondence goes back and forth. And then the publication will choose to either accept or reject it. So, and I don't think whether or not you've done a preprint directly affects whether or not you're eventually going to be published in, you know, let's say Nature or one of the other big journals.
No, No, I agree with you, Trevor. But I guess I see peer review as being a cloistered event where, you know, high flutants of like-minded read a paper and ask you a bunch of technical questions. From what I hear in this interview, Igor is getting some criticism through peers in this preprint. So although it has to go through the process of peer review, peers are reading these papers now and giving him insights and giving him criticism now.
They are. And I'm going to give Igor full credit that he agreed to our interviews. One of the things I did, and I'll make sure it's in the show notes, is there was another article basically written about Igor's study in a more populous place, a place called Project CBD, a place I really quite like going for info. And basically it was another PhD biochemist saying how much he didn't like Igor's paper. So rather than me try to come up with a bunch of questions for Igor, I just sort of sent him the paper and said, we'll talk about this. And, you know, he graciously said, sure, we can talk about the problems in the paper. So I commend Igor for, you know, happily talking about problems that have been pointed out.
Yeah, no, and I guess that's the whole point of a preprint, right, is you get it out there. Because as you said, right now with COVID, scientists are having a tough time getting into the lab. And I guess, I mean, could you imagine this fellow's been studying cannabis for 5 years, and all of a sudden in one of his experiments, he realizes that cannabis, the extract CBD extract, had an effect on an ACE2 inhibitor. And it could be beneficial. Geez, I got to let people know about this. Although the flaws, I mean, people look at this. And
yeah.
This is what he's done.
Well, and I think this is a fascinating COVID story. This is the part I really like is, you know, we've got a bunch of people out there, you know, learning how to make sourdough bread because they're stuck at home. Igor and his wife, you know, they'd been studying cannabis and they'd been looking at things like MS and psoriasis and rheumatoid arthritis. You know, basically diseases that are pro-inflammatory, and they were thinking that, you know, something in these cannabis extracts, especially the high CBD ones, was anti-inflammatory and might help. And so, you know, they've already got this database. They've got, you know, 400 different extracts, and they're, you know, narrowed it down to 24 that they think are really good anti-inflammatories. And then now suddenly they're stuck at home, and Igor's wife, Olga, who is another, you know, professor, find some papers saying, you know, back when it was SARS-1, you know, this ACE2 receptor on the cells was really important for the virus to get in. I wonder if that'll be important for this. And then, you know, does anything in our database affect ACE2? And then the scientists in China and Germany confirm that ACE2 is important for SARS-CoV-2. And so they've now got an idea, and they can't really get into the lab to test it. And then suddenly they can get into the lab like two people at a time and run a couple experiments. And they do, and they publish it. So, you know, instead of learning to do sourdough, these two, you know, learned a little bit of virology.
Well, they're getting a lot of press on this. If you Google COVID and ACE2, these guys come up. And, you know, Trevor, the funny thing about, not the funny thing, but the observation, when you're in the medical field long enough, you're able to say that you've seen it all or seen it before. I started nursing in 1980, just as the HIV AIDS epidemic was beginning. And in these 40 years, from my time starting nursing, when, you know, the joke about doing CPR on an HIV patient was not a great joke. The thing was, nurses were refusing to see AIDS patients, HIV patients. In these 40 years now, an HIV AIDS patient can actually live a long and fruitful life because we've done some incredible studies on HIV AIDS. Now we're in COVID, and now we got these preprints and you know, vaccines that usually take 5-6 years to come to market are coming to market in 6 months. So I think we're living in an interesting time, and I find it fascinating that cannabis is there too. How can cannabis help with COVID? So Trevor, I've been doing some studying. Let's help our listeners. Let's do a little review on an ACE inhibitor versus an ACE2 inhibitor.
Okay. Well, so in pharmacy world, an ACE inhibitor is a blood pressure pill, and ACE means angiotensin converting enzyme. So that's just an enzyme that lives in your body. And a ACE inhibitor blocks that enzyme. But the enzyme it's blocking is called ACE1. So ACE1 isn't, as far as we know, directly related to SARS-CoV-2. We think SARS-CoV-2, the gateway or the doorway that it gets into the cell with is a different enzyme or different receptor called ACE2. There's been some debate and study out there whether or not blood pressure pills called ACE inhibitors affect ACE2. There was some worry early on in the pandemic that everybody on ACE inhibitors was going to get COVID and die. That didn't happen. In fact, there's been some big studies published in JAMA and a few other places basically showing, no, it doesn't have any bad effects. And a paper or two that you were pointing out this morning, now there's some people out there looking to see if maybe ACE inhibitors might actually have some good effects COVID-wise, but that's far from proven. So right now, I think all we can say safely is ACE inhibitors seem to have no effect on whether or not you're going to get sick with COVID-19, because they seem to have no effect on whether or not the SARS-CoV-2 virus is going to get into your cell. And like everything else COVID-related, subject to change.
Okay, so let's look at this a little bit as a layman. We have skeletal muscles and we have smooth muscles. The skeletal muscles are obviously what move our arm and legs, right? We flex and we extend muscles, and those are the skeletal muscles. Now, ACE receptors are on the smooth muscle, right? So when you talk about, what's an example of an ACE inhibitor pill that you might dispense to somebody?
Enalapril.
Okay, now, so prills. So yeah. the prills affect the blood vessels, right? The smooth blood vessels of our body, and that's how it affects blood pressure, is by dilating the blood, the arteries, and therefore the heart doesn't have to pump as hard. So that's what an ACE receptor is, right? It's found in the smooth muscles.
Yeah, it does a few other things as well, including stuff in the kidneys and a few other things, but yes, it affects the blood pressure.
But those are all smooth muscles, right?
But we think some of the things it does in the kidneys are more hormone related, and some of the things it does in the heart. It's a complicated pill that it seems like ACE, like the enzyme, is literally all over the body. So it seems to have a lot of complicated effects.
Kind of like CB2 receptors all over the body.
Something like that, yes.
So ACE2, now the ACE2 is found in the tissues of your lungs and the tissues of your kidneys, tissues of your gastrointestinal tract. So Igor is looking at how COVID and CBDs affect the ACE2 receptors, right? And that's where this is a little different.
Right. And so what we think, and Igor agreed, I had this about right, the way I like to think about it is the ACE2 is a doorway into the cell. And the SARS-CoV-2 virus uses that doorway to get into the cell. Now it needs a key to get in. And the key is this famous spike protein you keep hearing about on the news, stuck all around the outside of SARS-CoV-2. But that key needs to be cut before it'll open the door. And that's this TMPRSS protein. So they were looking to see if the cannabis extracts can make less doors, less of these ACE2 receptors, and less key cutters. And so if you can make less of both, express less of those on the cells, does that mean we can have less SARS-CoV-2 virus getting into the cells?
Okay. All right, that makes sense. So I guess we should let the listeners hear what he has to say.
All right, let's go to Igor.
Nice to talk to you guys. Good morning. So I'm Igor Kowalczyk. I'm professor at the University of Lethbridge in Alberta. And so I've been in the university since 2001, researched medicinal herbs since 2008, working on medicinal poppy, and for the past 5 years working on cannabis.
Thank you, Igor. That's great. Now, you and your team, which has lots of Kowalczyks in it, I've got an Anna, an Olga, and an Igor. You put out a paper talking about using extracts of cannabis that had lots of CBD in it and how that might affect ACE2 expression. So let's just to keep our, get our audience up to speed. First thing I just want to ask, because honestly, before COVID-19, I don't think I'd ever heard of it before. Tell us what the difference is between a preprint and what we normally consider a peer-reviewed article.
Right. So frankly, I also did not, I heard about preprint, but never used one before COVID. So the preprint basically, it's a research publication that is not peer-reviewed, but that you can put online. So there are probably 5 or 6 journals that publish preprints. And they just basically check them for correctness in like a format and whatnot, but they don't check the scientific hypothesis, the data, and whatnot. So technically, those journals that put the preprints are not experts in the specific field, so that's why this research is not peer-reviewed, right? In contrast to other journals that are peer-reviewed, so typically you submit the paper, it goes to your peers, they criticize the paper, ask you to do something else, change this, change that, and you either publish in the same journal or elsewhere. I have published over 150 peer-reviewed articles, and on average, a submission goes through 3 to 5 journals, right? I mean, if you send to one, you may end up in journal number 10 3 years later. This is a very typical and very standard way how science is done. The only reason we've done the peer review, preprint publication without the peer review, because of the urgency. We wanted the people know the flexibility exists. We wanted to expose ourselves to criticism. And what's importantly, we wanted to attract the attention of our researchers and media and whatnot, so that we are able to get research money to conduct appropriate clinical trials to actually confirm our finding in vivo.
Okay, no, that's great. And and the other thing I hadn't heard of preprints before either, but I'm understanding, like you said, in this era of COVID, there's now more than 4,000 COVID preprints a week. So you guys are certainly not the only people putting out preprints in this COVID time. So let's talk about ACE2 and TMPRSS2. So ACE2, and jump in and correct me when I remember, just a pharmacist here, jump in and correct me when I'm going off the rails, but ACE2, mm-hmm. we think is kind of the doorway into the cell that the SARS-CoV-2 virus uses. And it sort of opens that door with the spike protein. And we think that one of the things that kind of helps cut that key is the TMPRSS2 protease, the enzyme. So ACE2 lets the virus into the cell, and this other protein, the TMPRSS2, kind of helps make the spike protein open up that door. Am I kind of on the right track?
You nailed it.
Okay, good. Thank you. So now the point of your paper, and again, tell me when I go off the rails, you wanted to see if we can, with things like CBD, with cannabis extracts, if you can have less ACE2 doorways and possibly less TMPRSS2 key cutting protein. That's sort of what we're aiming for.
Absolutely. So if you understand, a lot of pathogens enter the human cells through specific interaction with receptors on the surface of the cell. That means that pathogens are typically tissue-specific, right? That's why we have viruses like cold-causing viruses attack your nasopharyngeal and lung tissues. We have, hepatitis virus attacks liver, HIV, immune cells, and so on and so forth. So tissue specificity is granted by a recognition of a receptor on the surface of the cell, and that's what this virus does. So it recognizes ACE2. In addition to recognition, when the virus gets in and starts replicating, it forces other cells to amplify this receptor, right? So that means when the viral particle exits the infected cell, they have better chances to infect all other cells around it, right? So when we have thought that cannabis extracts can decrease the number of these receptors, we aimed at two purposes. So one, we thought that there was a potential for some sort of reduction in infection possibility, right? So for people who would take the extract. And second, reduction of the possibility to develop a disease or develop a moderate or severe form of disease. Because even if the person that is infected that starts taking the extract, there is a possibility that is not checked yet, it's not proven yet, but there is a possibility that taking the extract would reduce the actual disease development because simply we reduce the receptor expression on other cells and virus has a difficult time to infect you systemically.
Okay, no, that's good. Now, how about take a step back? Why would you or someone on your team have thought that cannabis extracts might affect ACE2 receptors at all?
Right. So basically that comes from our previous work where we have tested various extracts for their ability to reduce inflammation for a variety of conditions, whether it's a chronic or acute, different type of chronic inflammation. And we were just preparing the clinical trials on diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, skin conditions like psoriasis and whatnot. So we accumulated a lot of data, profiled over 400 cultivars and basically decreased the number of effective cultivars to about two dozen. So we knew that cannabis extracts, again, on our models, single cell and 3D tissues, have a very strong potential to regulate variety of inflammatory processes. So our initial idea was just to use the cannabis extract to reduce inflammation and therefore severity of the disease. But when Olga Kowalczyk, my wife and business partner and colleague, started reading more on how the SARS virus itself from back 2004 or 5 interacts with cells. So she found a couple articles showing the importance of ACE2, and she just suspected back early in February that this virus, even just because of similarity, may do the same. And simply what we have done, without any experiments, our bioinformaticians started profiling our data for the ACE2 expression and expression of other receptors and identified that in many target tissues that we have analyzed before, these receptors indeed are reduced. And then I believe in 2-3 weeks after that came a confirmation from German and Chinese groups that ACE2 is indeed a critical receptor to target, and then they reported on the second protein as well, and that's when we tested the second protein and also found that it is reduced, not to the same degree, but also substantially. So that's basically part serendipity, part basically, we had something to do because, of the COVID, we could not go to the lab. We only got granted the permission to get back to the lab, and only for two people in April, and that's when we started to doing some additional experiments. And even now we are still on a very reduced load, so only three people are allowed to work because the university is still in shutdown.
Well, I'm not sure if I'm glad the scientists have the same restrictions as the rest of us, or maybe we'll just commiserate that like everybody else, you've been more or less stuck at home with small outings. Okay. Other things that maybe because I don't read these things often, I had never heard of 3D tissues. So you were using something called epi-airway, epi-oral, and epi-interstitial tissues. So this isn't just a few mucosal cells in a petri dish. This is something different. Can you sort of describe to our audience what these things are that you were doing your tests on?
Right. So the 3D tissues are basically engineered human tissues. So they come from real patients, right? So they are made from layers of cells. So depending whether it's the lung, oral, or intestine, so they literally mimic tissues of our organism, right? And so there are many companies that produce that, and MustPak is one of them. And that's where we use the tissues of this company. And so basically, they can make it sex-specific, right? So male, female. They can make it age-specific or even a condition-specific. So they can mimic colitis, psoriasis, and many other diseases, right? So that's basically 3D tissue. It's engineered human tissue, right?
Oh, thank you very much. And then before you started applying your extracts to it, you basically caused them to become artificially inflamed with things like tumor necrosis factor. So that was sort of to mimic the tissues being sick. Is that kind of the idea?
Absolutely. So as you've seen what's happening with main infection processes, with number of pathogens, whether it's a bacterial, viral, fungal, there is an inflammation, so it's a natural response of our immune system to fight off pathogens. And so we wanted to mimic in vitro the inflammation process. So please understand that this inflammation process is not specific to the virus. It occurs in many different diseases, but specific molecules that are targeted. So, for example, with COVID-causing virus, it's TNF-alpha and interleukin-6. So they're probably most important ones. So when we focus on what molecules are targeted, we focus on these two. But in addition, we profiled close to 100 of different pro-inflammatory molecules and even developed our own computer algorithm that the computer basically searches for a pattern that is specific for the COVID infection. And that was in part was reported in the second paper.
Okay. And it might be nitty detail, but it was just because it was a chemical I recognized. So DMSO was your carrier. Now, as a compounding pharmacist, yeah. I actually use DMSO in the lab too. And I just thought that was an interest, and tell me if I'm wrong, an interesting choice, because as a drug, DMSO, we actually treat things like cystitis with it, and it is sort of an anti-inflammatory all on its own. So does using DMSO as a carrier sort of interfere with the anti-inflammatory effects that you're hoping to have from the cannabis extracts?
Right. It's an excellent question, and that's why a proper control has to be always done, and we'll of course use this, right? So the DMSO is basically, as you said, it's a carrier that brings molecules across, let's say, extracellular matrix, cell membrane, and whatnot. So because we're dealing with artificial tissue, we don't have a blood supply, you know, that allows the molecules to come in proximity of receptors and whatnot on the petri dish. In order to apply the molecule, you need to use something that would allow the active ingredient through efficiently. And so when we did all the comparisons, obviously we compared the effect of extract against DMSO, right? So there is a DMSO treatment separately, and there is a DMSO plus extract. And when we are saying that there is a reduction by 50, 70, or 80%, it means reduction against the control of DMSO.
Okay. Okay, now, so you want to find out if there is going to be less ACE2 expressed. Now, how does that work? I've read in the paper you both looked at the amount of RNA and the amount of protein to try to figure out how much less ACE2 was expressed after you put on the cannabis extract. So what are you looking at? Like how do you figure out how much ACE2 is in there, and how does the amount of RNA and protein help you figure that out?
Right. It's an excellent question, and it's always a dilemma for many scientists how correctly present the data on reduction of expression. And that's where a lot of criticism comes from as well for many papers, including potentially ours. So if you talk about the expression The expression is a process of making a transcript from a gene. So a gene is a portion of DNA where a specific sequence is located that encodes a specific protein, let's say, right? Not always, but mostly. So this gene makes an RNA in the process of transcription, and RNA often is an indication, let's say, of how much of this molecule is in the cell, right? And then in the process of translation, the RNA is converted to protein, right? And a protein is basically what receptor is. So if the protein acquires a certain tertiary or quaternary structure and gets embedded into the plasma membrane, and that's how it becomes transmembrane protein. Right? So there are, of course, additional modifications that make the protein active, inactive. Let's skip that part. But very often there is a linearity between the level of RNA and the level of protein. But there are many cases when it's not, right? And so when we just measure the RNA, which is easy because there are methods that you can do it in bulk for thousands and thousands of molecules. So okay. That gives you an indication of the entire pathway. But the protein you have to do one by one through the so-called Western blot. And the quantification is just detection of intensity of the image of a protein that comes from, you know, staining the gel and just technicality. So.
Okay. No, I think we're at least grasping why you did both. And even though the RNA is an easier test to do, it doesn't always correlate exactly to how much ACE2 receptor there is. And the Western blot for the protein is harder to do, but possibly more accurate for the amount of protein. That makes sense to me. So a few critiques out of the paper that I sent you. And again, we'll try not to get too bogged down to details for our listeners because no one's looking at graphs in front of us. But just a couple, I guess they were pointing out some, and maybe these are just hard things to do in the lab. Like one of your runs, the control solution, the DMSO, it's figure 2A and 2B. The amount of DMSO in run A seemed to have more RNA in it than in run B. And you would think that, you know, if it was the control, it should be the same or very similar. And another one was talking about in the protein end of things that your control protein, the GAPDH, looked like it was overloaded, like there was basically too many cells had been run through. So it was then hard to tell if you had more ACE2 protein or less ACE2 protein because the control, there was so much protein in it. Can you talk to either of those criticisms and just try to walk through for non-lab people if these are valid or just, you know, problems that pop up in labs?
Right. It's a great question, and these are details that are typically addressed in the battles, continued years of battles between reviewers and authors, right? So when we talk about individual DMSO, and forgive me, I don't have the paper in front of me, but I'm just thinking that you probably refer to the fact that seen between different tissues and between different experiments. So when you do an experiment, the only valid comparison is within the same experiment. So even if you talk about the same tissues, even the same preparation of cells, so in order to make it even, so you distribute them into wells, so hopefully that your pipette is ideal, but as any instrument, it makes mistakes. It's unavoidable. So that's how loading becomes unequal, for example, right? Then when we talk about staining of the gel, using specific, you know, chemical reactions and whatnot. It depends on what side of the gel that is, because edges are not as equally covered by destaining or, you know, detection solution, yada, yada. So all this technicality, there are three or four steps that easily can introduce an error or bias. That's why we do three, four, five, whatever experiments. At that time, as I mentioned before, we only had the possibility to do two experiments, and that's where there were only two reps. And because we were not allowed in the lab for a long time and really wanted to have this story out, we erase the criticism and only expose ourselves based on two experiments. So when we give the average, we give the average of two experiments, and when we give an image, even just a representation. So it's kind of saying, well, my calculations are done on these images, so you should trust me, right? And of course, you automatically expose yourself to a criticism because the image is not perfect, or like in the case of being overloaded, it would be very easy. Like overloading means, so when we basically detect this, we could use instead of a minute, use only 10 seconds. And then you will see a perfect picture of exposure without any overloading. So every scientist knows it, right? So we didn't want to use this trick like that and just show whatever it was, right? So in both cases, a gap DH is basically a very abundant protein. So it's very easy to, quote, overload it. And in most of the publications, when you see that, people use the trick of light staining to show a thin band, right? So and I don't want to uncover all the mechanisms of how you beautify the image, because image is irrelevant for quantification purposes, right? So again, I can debate every point of criticism, but at the same time, I agree with the individual who wrote it, right? So right now, in fact, we are addressing the criticism for both papers from both journals. So we are in the process of answering the questions. There are some very constructive criticisms. So there are many questions where they agree with us. And I am certain that these papers will be published. But I don't know whether it will take half a year or two.
No, I appreciate how honest you've been with us. And no, I think you've addressed all the questions I had. Now, just kind of an interesting thing. So you did find that some of your cannabis strains seemed to reduce the expression, but it also looked like you had a couple strains that seemed to increase the expression of ACE2, possibly, like, you know, we are currently thinking that cigarette smoking increases the expression of ACE2. Is it possible that some cannabis extracts actually might make it more likely then for you to get SARS-CoV-2, or is that something for another experiment or another day?
I think it is possible. I would not use the argument of smoking per se, because the argument of ACE2 increase in smoking was given by tobacco smoking, right? So yes, cannabis smoking entirely the same, but combustion products are very different, and we have modulating effects of active ingredients in forms of cannabinoids and terpenoids. Until the proper experiment of smoking cigarettes that are different on the active ingredients and showing me that ACE2 is differently regulated, I would not buy the argument. However, at the same time, absolutely, that's the point of what we're showing, that the different cultivars of strain are very different in their capacity. And mind you, we only showed and profiled the about 20-24 cultivars out of 400 that have been pre-selected already, right? So when we arrived at the idea of using these cultivars for what we did, we used those that were extremely active against other or other similar processes with inflammation. So that means that the percentage of cultivars that actually are very good is very small, right? And in the second paper, we very clearly show anti-inflammatory properties of several lines and present two lines, one where there was no difference and one where there were completely opposite effects. On not on one, not on two genes, but on entire pathways, a very strong pro-inflammatory cannabis line. And mind you, that line was also high CBD line. So again, cannabis is not generic.
No, I agree. So where does your research go next? Like, you are involved with a couple startup companies. We have Swish.inc and Pathways Research. Is the hope that after some of your findings have been sort of verified, and is it to go on to some sort of animal or clinical trials? Where do you think this is going to go?
Right. So, so we have started animal research last fall with several varieties that were strong anti-inflammatory. We have some preliminary behavior studies because obviously we want to make sure that there's no changes, impairment, toxicology. We're in the process right now of another two animal studies, primarily, again, on the safety rather than the efficacy. And so right now we engaged with two groups from the U.S., preparing clinical trial on prophylactics, right? So even one specific type of extract and doses, and for treatment, again, using specific concentrations and specific varieties to hopefully to prevent side effects and whatnot. So we would not make any claims that this that cannabis can be used for COVID until we've done a phase two trial and have the results.
Thank you, Igor. This has been fascinating. Anything else you wished I'd ask, thought I was going to ask? Anything else you think our listeners need to hear about? Need to hear about your work on cannabis extracts and the SARS-CoV-2 virus?
Well, yes and no. So, probably the most difficult part. And I don't want to call myself a pioneer, but the one who exposes a preliminary research is the criticism. And, of course, the vigilantes, like the one who made extensive comments of our work, rather nasty comments, so I would probably accept all scientific comments if they were not peppered by personal comments. He is doing the right job, so they want to make people aware. But that person is also a businessman, CEO, head of the company. So that makes their comment very wishy-washy, in my opinion.
Okay, Kirk, I really like that. I really enjoyed my talk with Igor. I know it was a little dense. What else do we need to talk about now that we're back out of Igor and giving our heads a shake a bit?
Well, it was very dense. But you know what? I appreciated going back and doing my pathophysiology review on the ACE receptors. But here's the thing that I marvel at. You know, fast food restaurants are now giving you Beyond Meat burgers. So is this man making Beyond Petri dish burgers? Like he's basically cloning, growing human tissues in the lab.
Yeah. Well, no, I thought that part was fascinating too. Now he actually bought these 3D printed bits of, you know, basically lung and throat and mucosal tissue. And I didn't even know those were the things. So yeah, it's not just a couple little mucosal cells in a Petri dish. It's like a pre-grown section of trachea or pre-grown section of lung. And to the point that, you know, it can be male, it can be female. And like you said, in some of their other trials, because before this, they were looking at all sorts of inflammatory diseases, you know, they can be, you know, one that looks like it has inflammatory bowel disease. So that I didn't know these things existed before talking to Igor.
Well, I really enjoyed that part of the conversation because I kept thinking to myself, well, this is really curious. So they can actually now experiment on actual human tissue that's been grown in the lab. But yet he also made a comment that was interesting. When you're dealing with the inflammatory process of the human body, circulation of fresh blood and the immune system, the T cells and you know, the immune system response, it's critical. So it's almost, I wonder if having human cells cuts both ways. You have the advantage of having the experiment on human cells, but you're having a disadvantage of the human cells not behaving the way they should in the real environment. I found that fascinating.
Well, yeah, and that's where, and I know I might be getting into minutia, but that's where I was talking to him about DMSO. So that was the carrier that was taking his cannabis extracts through the tissue. And we use DMSO in the pharmacy lab, in the compounding lab, because, well, one of the things I do with it is I'll put an antifungal in DMSO. And the reason I'll do that is the DMSO will let the antifungal pass through your toenail. So if you have toenail fungus, DMSO will let you sort of paint on this toenail fungus treatment. And it's usually very difficult to get stuff through toenails. So DMSO will let it pass through. So he's sort of using DMSO in a similar way, is it'll sort of drive stuff through tissue. But yeah, so that was neat. And the other thing I really liked that I think he nailed down sort of for the criticisms, you know, most of the criticisms were, you know, he didn't do enough trials and he didn't do, you know, the pictures of the stains weren't right. And I think he really nailed down that, look, they weren't allowed in the lab. You know, this was, you know, they were allowed to run in the lab, two people run, you know, a handful of experiments and got an interesting result. And he says, of course we could have, you know, redone them later when we could get back in and do dozens or hundreds of trials. And yes, we could have made the pictures look prettier by doing a bunch of techniques to it, but we really thought we had an interesting result. So we want to just sort of show it to the world, warts and all, just to say, hey, there's something really interesting going on here. So I thought that was very honest of him. And, you know, like you said, he knew if we put this up early, we're going to be opening ourselves to criticism when they were, but it's not like they were being sloppy. It was COVID. They weren't allowed in the lab. This was as much as they could do before the preprint.
But once again, cannabis, it confounds us, because at the very end of the interview, you raised the issue that they not find that some of the strains actually work the opposite. So you have the high CBD. Now, I think we've had this conversation. When I think of CBD, I think of ibuprofen. When I think of THC, I think of Tylenol. You know, Tylenol is the analgesic. Ibuprofen, NSAIDs tend to be an anti-inflammatory. So, I know that it's a very, very flat, you know, there's flaws in this, but that's the way I sort of look at CBDs and Tylenol and THC. But what at the very end of his episode, at his discussion, he says that one strain actually may have actually progressed COVID, and one strain, while the other strain inhibited COVID. So, again, cannabis confounds us.
Yeah, no, I found that part fascinating. Yeah, so just like you, is I put the word CBD together with anti-inflammatory. Like, that's what it does. And this was a high CBD strain that both showed more inflammation and actually increased the amount of ACE2 receptors. What does that mean? Well, we don't know, other than, like he said right at the end, is, you know, cannabis isn't generic. Like, you know, one, yeah. And we hear that from the medical patients all the time, you know, this strain helped me, this one did not. So, you know, it is a, as usual, a fascinating plant.
So there we go, Trevor. We have our COVID episode. Cannabis could actually help us fight COVID if you get the right strain.
Right. And I want us to be careful. And I know our listeners are all smart and willed. As fascinating as Igor and his team's research is, this is bench science. So this, yes, is a long, long way away from us saying that this is going to help people in a clinical trial. Like, if you look at like hydroxychloroquine, you know, we thought it was good. There's lots of theoretical reasons to think it was good. And then it turned out not to be. And it's not quite the same, but so in cancer research, we think that despite, you know, a bunch of successful preclinical work, about 85% of the early clinical trials never make it to phase three. And phase three is the one where they put it into humans. And only about 50% of the ones that in cancer that get to phase three actually make it to market. So as fascinating and well done, et cetera, as the research is on the bench in the lab, it's a long way from saying that, you know, cannabis fights COVID. This is fascinating, and I hope it goes somewhere, but there's a lot of trials left to go before we put it for sure into humans.
Well, and this can't possibly be our last COVID episode either, because, you know, in all due respect to this first wave and second wave, my observations and experience and studying suggest that we're not in a wave of COVID. We're in a tsunami of COVID. It's just one giant wave. We're going to be talking about COVID for another year anyway. So I'm sure there's going to be more opportunity to bring cannabis into the COVID story.
Oh, absolutely. Kirk, that was another really good one. What should people do if, you know, they say, I want to have my message in front of all these smart, kind of curious people?
Well, you know, Trevor, our project, Reefer Madness, has been built on word of mouth. I've always asked people, if you like our podcast, tell a friend. We would like to have all sorts of people listening to us. We try to create stories that follow the pillar of Reefer Medicine, Reefer Madness, and Reefer Mellow. I think there's something for everybody. This episode we just finished might be a little bit more of a clinician's episode. Whereas, you know, we've also had episodes with musicians in the key of weed, which is open to anybody. So I think people should listen to our episodes and tell their friends. And, you know, if you want to have an international audience listening to your about a product you want to sell, let us know and we will. We're looking for sponsors.
Yep. Send us an email at podcast@reefermed.ca and we'll be more than happy to tell you about your sponsorship opportunities.
That was great, guys. I guess it's my turn now to add a piece of music to the end of the episode. And trying to keep it local, we, of course, produce this podcast out of Dauphin, Manitoba, in the studios of CKDM Radio. And just north of here is a small fishing village called Winnipegosis. And there is an artist named Nelson Rudiak. He's actually quite the accomplished jazz musician out of New York. And his father is from Winnipegosis, and he came out with an album called Winnipegosis, and seeing as it's summer, I figured I'd play a song from that album, and it's called Barbecue Boogie. So here is Nelson Rudiak, whose father was born in Winnipegosis, to finish off the Reefer Madness podcast.
Like the show? Let us know. We're Reefer Madness on Instagram and Facebook, at Reefer Madness on Twitter, or head over to the website at reefermed.ca to find out what we're all about and what's coming up next. Talk to you later.
So you go ahead.
No, I was clearing my throat.
Yeah, that was good, Trevor. I enjoyed that story. I have nothing more to say, I guess.